Our guest is a renowned expert on renewable energy, a consultant to the UN, formerly in charge of the World Bank's Renewable Energy Programme, who with 140 researchers from around the world led a stocktake report of global investment in renewable energy just a year or two ago. Dr. Eric Martineau is a scientist and was the convening author for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His expertise includes the economics of renewable energy options, such as wind, solar, biomass and biofuels. As the world grapples with the challenge of finding alternative energy sources to carbon-emitting fossil fuels like oil and coal, how much progress has been made on a shift to renewable resources, especially in energy-hungry countries like the US and China? Are renewables economic compared to fossil fuels? What are the barriers to greater investment? And is the shift coming at a fast enough pace, including here in New Zealand? Well, Dr. Eric Martineau has worked in Washington and Beijing. He now lives in Tokyo, where he's research fellow with the World Watch Institute. But he's in New Zealand teaching a month-long course at Victoria University, and he's with me now here in our Wellington studio. Nice to have you with us.
Oh, thank you. Good morning.
So, first of all, is the world running out of the supply of oil that we've become accustomed to? What is your analysis of peak oil and the prognosis for future supplies?
Well, I think that's still an open question. Of course, this question has arisen many times in the last 30, 40 years in terms of where we're heading. I think it will become a serious problem. But at the same time, I'm very optimistic because I think we will be finding substitutes for oil, and in particular, the electrification of our transport system. In other words, turning more and more towards electric vehicles. We'll talk about biofuels, but I think that more and more of our transport will become electric in the future, and this will relieve the pressure on oil.
There is clearly, though, a pressure on oil other than that is being controlled by the price of oil by the cartels.
Yes. Well, as you said, I lived in China for 3 years in Beijing, teaching at Tsinghua University. And, of course, the Chinese government is very concerned about oil imports, as are many countries, including New Zealand, and are working very hard to look at substitutes for oil. And that does include biofuels. It includes also liquids from coal, which are actually quite bad for the climate in terms of carbon emissions, unless you can somehow capture that carbon, and electric vehicles. They've made now major inroads towards that.
All countries, certainly all OECD countries anyway, are trying to deal with their carbon emissions, irrespective of what's happening with oil. In large part from fossil fuels like coal and oil, of course, these emissions. They're having to look to alternative sources because of climate change concerns. Where is the world at in terms of finding alternative sources for energy?
Yeah, well, I've been looking at renewable energy for the last 20 years, and you know, things gathered momentum in the 1990s, but in the last 5 years, since we started publishing this Renewables Global Status Report, and we're now working on the fourth annual edition just now, I was working on it this past weekend here at the university, the last 5 years have just been tremendous. It's just been off the charts. Everything in renewable energy has doubled, tripled, quadrupled, increased by factors of higher, fivefold and more. I think an example is investment in renewable energy, to just sort of highlight the growth. Investment in renewable energy was $150 billion last year worldwide. Now, that $150 billion in new capacity for renewable energy, you want to compare that to perhaps $300 billion in investment in the power sector worldwide for all technologies. So renewables.
So half as much as being invested.
As being invested in all power technologies worldwide. And that $150 billion in renewable energy has grown from just $30 billion in 2004. So in the space of 5 years, we've seen a fivefold increase in investment in renewables.
Can we get clear about what we're talking about with renewables? What are the main options and where are they at? Wind is a leading option.
Yes. We've seen growth rates of 25 to 30% in wind power consistently for the last several years. The United States took the lead last year. Germany had been the leader for a decade in wind power, but the U.S. Somewhat surprisingly took the lead last year and installed 8.5 gigawatts of wind power in 1 year. Now, that 8.5 gigawatts is equal to New Zealand's entire electric power sector, and that was installed in 1 year in wind power in the U.S.
So wind and the other major contributors or the most promising options are?
Well, solar PV, solar electricity, is coming along. It's still quite expensive. Governments are subsidizing it heavily, and it is growing. There are now over 2 million homes worldwide with solar electric on the roof. generating power into the grid, using it themselves. So that's emerging, and many people are very optimistic about the costs coming down by half or even more in the next couple of years. And so we'll see a lot more solar PV, I think, on rooftops around the world. Then also we have solar hot water, which is also very important for many countries, including New Zealand. And solar hot water is now on 50 million rooftops worldwide. Most of those are in China. The Chinese have made great gains with solar hot water. But there's no reason not to heat water using the sun. It's much more practical and it is cost effective. So that's another major one. And then finally, we have seen huge growth in biofuels.
We've also seen huge problems with biofuels, obviously, with the substitution of crops being grown for food now being grown for fuels. Where are those difficulties at in terms of combating them?
Well, Brazil has increased its biofuels, its ethanol production, by 50% in just the last 2 years. And a lot of that, of course, all of that comes from sugarcane, and that's, you know, they're clearing forests to grow the sugar cane. So that is,
which has an inverse effect, the opposite effect in terms of global or climate change policy, because you're clearing
trees. There is a lot of controversy about the net carbon benefit from ethanol and biodiesel, the two biofuels. And in fact, the European Union has just enacted a requirement, a standard. They have a target for future use of biofuels, 10% in the transport sector by 2020. And they've said that the biofuels used for that target must be sustainable.
How do you get around that? I mean, if you've got farmers saying, I can make more money by growing crops for fuel, I can clear, you know, trees and grow crops for fuel, how do you somehow make that sustainable?
Yeah. Well, the EU requirements relate to biodiversity and land use and clearing, and they also relate to the net carbon benefit from biofuels. They say that biofuels have to reduce carbon emissions by at least 35% relative to ordinary gasoline or diesel fuel in the alternative. So that's what they've operationalized, or they've made this requirement. But in my own view, there are very serious problems. The first one is food supply. And of course, the U.S. has produced its ethanol in all from corn. And that's been dictated partly by agricultural policy and subsidy in the U.S. There have been large subsidies given to biofuels, now several billion dollars a year going as subsidies to biofuels in the U.S. And that's impacted corn prices. It's impacted prices of substitute grains. You're seeing effects on poor people in developing countries, in particular Mexico, where they depend on corn as a staple. A lot of people are suffering. So I think that the impacts on food supply and food prices from biofuels grown as energy crops, both biodiesel and sugar and corn, are very serious.
It's hard to see a way around it, in fact, isn't it, as a mass supply. What about biomass? Because we have some projects underway here, including the sort of algae, I think, you know, the sludge on top of the ponds in Marlborough. What prospect does that kind of project have, and what contribution is it making to renewables?
Well, biomass is used around the world for heating and electricity, and in particular countries like northern European countries have a lot of biomass from forest industries and so on that they can burn. All of that waste biomass, by the way, from the forest industries and even from agriculture waste, can be converted into cellulosic ethanol. And that's a very important development.
So it's a different source of biofuel.
It's a different source of biofuel from sugar or from corn. And that I am optimistic about. I really don't think we're going to see much biofuel in the future from plantation crops. But I think we can see a lot of ethanol produced from cellulosic waste, which is basically just
And it's genuine waste? It's not part of the forest cycle.
It would otherwise rot or be burned for other purposes, but it can be converted chemically into an ethanol fuel. And that's still not commercial. It's still more expensive, but there are many investments now in commercial scale plants with government subsidies around the world, and we're seeing a major trend towards these cellulosic biofuels plants.
If that's the case, then, that you're seeing this massive increase, perhaps in the last 5 years, in investment, what does it add up to, though? What percentage of the energy production, if you like, worldwide, is now coming from renewable sources?
Well, overall, if you look at electricity, it's about 18%. Most of that is large hydro, and only about 2% of that is so-called new renewables, which would be wind and solar and biomass for power generation. But that figure is growing very fast, the share from so-called new renewables, and it's growing much faster than any other technology. Solar electricity has been growing by 60-70% a year for the last couple of years, and there's no sign that that will slow, although with the current economic conditions, it's possible that the industry, you know, will also go through the same downturn as many others.
It's interesting whether you consider electricity in some ways genuinely renewable, because yes, the water is renewable, but as is the case in this country, you can run out of new sites to dam, can't you, in order to increase capacity?
Right. Large hydropower using dams and reservoirs has not been growing very fast, perhaps 1 or 1.5% per year. And those sites have pretty much been gone, and there aren't a lot of new developments in large hydropower. China and Brazil are really the only ones, and some in India. But we're seeing small hydropower on very small scales where no reservoir is required. We're seeing pumped hydro storage where you can store electricity in a reservoir and then use it during the peaking time when you need it. And we're seeing all of these other renewable electricities, particularly wind and solar PV, as coming in large shares.
But when push comes to shove, did I hear you say perhaps 18% of our energy supplies worldwide coming from hydro and then just 2% from other forms of renewable?
Yes.
Which is still tiny, isn't it?
Yes, still tiny, but growing very fast.
What are the other alternatives to oil then that are being used? Is it mainly nuclear in places like the US and UK?
Alternatives to oil.
Alternatives to oil, yes.
There really aren't any yet. Nuclear power really has not been growing at all in the last, 20, 30 years, except in a few countries like China, France, Japan. But now if you look at it, there's almost as much renewable power capacity in the world as nuclear power capacity. And in another 2 or 3 years, there will be more renewable power capacity than nuclear worldwide.
Why do you say that, just on the current rate of investment?
Just the current rate of investment and growth. There's no question that renewables will overtake nuclear in terms of total installed capacity, not necessarily energy production. So all of that electricity is currently feeding into our grid, but eventually we're going to get to the point where we can use that to power our vehicles, as I mentioned before, electric vehicles. And renewable energy and electric vehicles are a match made in heaven, because the electric vehicles give you storage. And you can charge them up when you have the renewables and not charge them up when you don't have it. So once it can be balanced through so-called smart grids or intelligent management, so that whenever the wind is blowing, you're charging up vehicle batteries, and when it's not, you don't have to. And then people can run their cars off of renewable power. They can run it off of wind and solar.
That would be transformational.
That would be very transformational,
and
yes.
And how far away is it?
Well, we're looking at perhaps a 20-year timescale.
Sounds a long time in terms of the warnings that we're having currently about need to act.
The International Energy Agency used to be very conservative about renewables, but they came out with a scenario just last year that showed renewables achieving up to 47% of global electricity by the year 2050, and perhaps even sooner than that. So that's half of all of electricity in the world could come from renewables on that sort of a timescale within 30 to 40 years. And in addition, that would then start to power our transport fleet and reduce our need for oil, except in the most high-value uses for oil, which would be freight and airlines and so on.
It seems incredible, given the demand for transport fleets across the world, that renewables could do it. You mentioned wind, and obviously one of the issues with wind is sometimes it doesn't blow.
Right.
You're saying you can coordinate your central grids to make use of when the wind's blowing to power vehicles. But even then, is there enough to do that across huge industrial nations like the US and what China is becoming?
I believe yes. You need storage, and we don't have good storage technologies yet. I'm talking about electric vehicles, which in another 10 years, 5 to 10 years, battery technology needs to evolve. Right now, we don't have batteries which are good enough. But we will have them, I'm convinced. And battery technology eventually will grow by leaps and bounds, as perhaps we're seeing in the computer industry. So,
why are you convinced that it will happen? Because the reward is so great for
whoever
can crack
it? The reward is so
great.
There is so much interest and money being spent now on battery research. That's really a leading edge area now. All of the car makers are turning their attention towards electric vehicles. You know, we've had a lot of attention on hydrogen and fuel cell vehicles in the past 10 years, but I think that's fading, and I think you see seriously automakers in Japan, in China, in the U.S. turning their attention strongly towards electrics. And you have countries now like Israel and some places in the U.S., California, saying that this is a priority for them now.
I guess it's a race, isn't it? And that's the issue, because you hear about all this new investment, and it is significant in numbers. At the same time, in China, a place you're very familiar with, we hear about two new coal-fired power stations being opened a week. So as its demand, despite the current, you know, sag in the world conditions, as its demand continues, can its investment in renewables keep up with what it's going to be emitting?
China is a very interesting case, and the Chinese government has made all forms of energy development a priority just because they've suffered through severe shortages, and they're trying to develop everything they can, including nuclear, including renewables. When I first came to China in 2005, soon after I got there, they passed a landmark renewable energy law, February 2005, which has resulted in many things, including the total wind power in China doubling every single year for the last 5 years. So it went from 350 to 700 to 1,500 to 3,000 to 6,000, and last year it was 12,000 megawatts. And they've achieved their target 2 years early. They had a target for 2010 and in wind power, and they met it last year. And now they're going to triple their target for 2020 and looking at 100 gigawatts of wind power, 10 or 12 times New Zealand's power system by 2020. And so they're very serious about this because they see it as an industrial technology. They see it as a new industry for them, new jobs, being a world leader in an important technology. There were only one or two companies 4 years ago in China producing wind turbines. Now there are 16 and 40 more who are developing components and turbines themselves, and seven joint ventures and subsidiaries of foreign companies. So it's a huge industry now in China. It's become a major industry. The government has been supporting it. And so wind is very important for them. They're going to turn to solar electric soon, although it hasn't really happened yet. It's been too expensive for them, and they haven't been willing to subsidize it. And, of course, they have to look at coal, because coal is a major energy source in China. They have huge coal resources, and they're going to have to use those more intelligently, so-called clean coal, not just reducing emissions from ordinary power plants, but eventually capturing the carbon from burning the coal and storing that carbon somewhere. And many countries are interested in this, in pushing China in this direction in terms of capturing the carbon. The Chinese really are interested in making more efficient use of their coal, cleaner use of their coal, but not necessarily moving strongly yet in the direction of carbon and carbon capture. And of course, if they don't, then the carbon emissions from China using all of that coal are going to swamp the world in terms of what happens.
It does, it's almost like a thriller, really, isn't it? But one that potentially has a most unfortunate outcome. It does feel like a race against time. You write reports for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. When you hear the sort of projections coming out of our scientists working with others in Antarctica, is there time to get the technologies in place to solve these problems, to mitigate the worst-case scenario coming out of those scientists for this century?
If you look at some of the worst-case prognoses, and that is that we have
up to 6 degrees Celsius increase, yeah.
We have to stabilize carbon emissions at 450 parts per million, and this would take place sometime in the 2030, 2040, 2050 time frame. Then we have to start reducing global emissions of carbon very soon. We can't really keep increasing beyond much another, 10 years. And even then, the rate of increase has to already start to come down. So under that most severe scenario, we need drastic action, drastic policies, I think even beyond the growth rates that we've seen in renewables, in fuel switching to natural gas, in cleaner use of coal. Now, I'm a bit more optimistic, I think, than the worst-case scenarios, and I think we have more time. I think that we can afford to continue along the aggressive trajectory we have, but doesn't have to be necessarily severe or very drastic.
Scientists telling Barack Obama he's got to get it done in his first term, yeah. Or it's too late. You disagree with that?
Yeah, I do. I think we do have time for it, and it's a natural progression in some sense, because the business case is there now for all of these cleaner technologies, and people have been making a lot of money on them in these last couple of years. And the current economic downturn notwithstanding, they will continue to make a lot of money on it. You can invest in a wind turbine, and you're sure it's going to be there, and you can get a return on it for the rest of its 20-year life. do the same thing with any bank or treasury investment, and who knows?
Well, you're on a winning game there, aren't you? 26 and a half minutes past 10 now on Radio New Zealand National. I'm talking to Dr. Eric Martineau, an international expert on renewable energy. Let's look at New Zealand then, because we have this goal, the last government anyway, had this goal to have 90% renewables by 2025. Are we anywhere near on track to achieving that?
Well, New Zealand has been running about 65 to 70% of its electricity from renewables historically, and that's almost all the large hydropower. And I think that the 90% target is quite achievable. What it will require actually is a lot of demand side energy efficiency improvements as well to keep total demand growth constant which have not been going that well. So there's a lot more that New Zealand can do and should do to improve energy efficiency. And that includes, for example, solar hot water heaters to display some of the electricity, not all of it, but some of it used for hot water heating, better insulated houses so that the energy losses are lower, more efficient appliances and lights, all these sorts of things must be done. Then given that, the increase in power generation and ultimately the retirement of some of the existing fossil fuel generation in the longer term could bring the country easily to 90%. I would say most of that's going to be wind power, some geothermal.
How much is needed? Because at the moment, you know, in central Otago, there's a battle over wind farms down there. There's just been one just off out the back of Wellington here. How do you measure the economics, I guess, in the broadest sense of the word, of one form of power versus another? For a start, is it actually cheaper at the moment, renewables, or is it cheaper to be using coal?
Well, wind power is becoming competitive with even coal. So the price of wind power is coming in line. It's being supported in the U.S., for example, at 2 cents per kilowatt hour more than conventional power. And that 2 cent addition has spurred a lot of the wind power development in these last couple of
years.
That's
through a subsidy, is it?
That's a subsidy, right, that the U.S. government pays. In Europe, it's not a government subsidy. It's a different system. It's called a feed-in tariff, and they basically provide a higher price for wind power that's shared among all of the utility customers. They all pay some fractional amount higher per kilowatt hour. But those levels of subsidies are coming down, and they're not needed as much as they were even 3 years ago because the prices of wind power and the performance of the turbines are increasing. New Zealand has an enormous wind resource, and I'm not downplaying the environmental and social issues in terms of resource consents and social acceptability and so on, because there are those. But if you look at the current pipeline of projects, wind power projects in New Zealand, it's about 900 megawatts that are consented or in the pipeline. And so that's already representing a tripling of existing capacity. And there have been various scenarios. There's a Greenpeace scenario last year that said New Zealand could get to 3,000 from, you know, beyond that 900. I personally think that New Zealand will get to 4,000. This is perhaps the year 2025.
This is a fourfold increase on what's in the pipeline now.
And what's in the pipeline now, that's right, in the next 15 to 20 years.
How many more farms is that? Realistically, how many more parts of the country would be turned into wind farms for that to happen?
Well, you'd be looking at something like 40 to 50 wind farms of 100 megawatts each.
New ones,
yes. So obviously that's a lot, but we're talking about half of what the U.S. installed last year alone. So I think it is practical. The main problem is, of course, as I mentioned before, energy storage and the ability of the grid to accept and accommodate all of that variability in terms of the wind. And the use of energy storage has to go along with that. And there are technologies being developed. They do cost money that can help to
manage the
fluctuate
supply.
And manage that fluctuation in the variability of wind, including pumped hydro storage.
It sounds easier than in reality it probably is.
Of course, the people who are doing this on the ground, you know, and making business deals and so on. But the point is that with renewables, you pay the full cost up front, and you know how much it's going to cost you. With other forms of power generation, you don't know what the market prices of coal and gas will be in the future. There's more uncertainty in terms of future fuel price variation. There are subsidies to coal and gas around the world that are skewing the cost comparisons and so on.
So what you're admitting is actually at the moment they're more expensive. If we were at 90% renewables now, how much higher would our power prices be now?
Well, I can't say exactly,
but they would be higher.
They might be slightly higher, but we're talking about fractional percentages, 5 to 10%.
If we're going to get to 90% by 2025, what policies are needed to incentivize that, do you believe?
Well, New Zealand appears on the verge of enacting this emissions trading system, which would essentially put a price on carbon. And that might alone increase the cost of coal power in this country by, say, 2 cents per kilowatt hour and automatically make wind competitive. But I think that the carbon trading system probably won't go far enough, and more will be needed, particularly if we're looking at New Zealand's share of aggressive carbon reductions in the next 20 years. And even beyond that, just looking at the introduction of electric vehicles and New Zealand's need to generate more electricity for the transport sector to avoid all those foreign oil imports.
That would include, if it were to shift primarily to electric cars and so forth, that would include a massive investment over and above what is needed.
Yes, that's right.
Does it have to be wind? Are we going to have to keep damming rivers as well?
I think that geothermal is very important here. I think that within 5 years, that solar electric you'll start to see it on a lot of rooftops here, and some biomass power generation using biogas, perhaps a lot of end-use energy efficiency. But I do think that wind is one of the major resources, and it will take not damming rivers, but perhaps creating some storage reservoirs in some likely locations.
Who's making the investment of this kind of transformation, I guess, in just 15 years' time? Yes, private companies are, but when you're talking about storage and those kind of issues, is there going to be a cost to the taxpayer as well?
Well, there are different approaches taken. In the United States, it is a cost to the taxpayer, now billions of dollars a year going to subsidize this production subsidy for wind power. In Europe, they have chosen not to use government subsidies and have instead enacted these feed-in tariffs, which set a guaranteed price for wind power producers. And I think that New Zealand might use a similar approach to a feed-in tariff here. It's not clear how that would work in the current electricity market. Another approach is called a portfolio standard, which requires utility companies to generate a certain percentage of their power from renewable energy. And we're seeing about 40 states, provinces, and countries around the world with these types of portfolio standards. Feed-in tariff is the most popular. There's about 50 countries around the world now with feed-in tariffs.
So where is New Zealand, the previous government or the current one, and looking anything like up to speed with what you're talking about?
Yeah. Well, I think when you look at renewable energy policy, New Zealand is pretty much at the bottom of the list in terms of the developed world.
Freudian slip.
But remarkably, you know, there still has been a lot of wind power development here, despite the lack of, you know, direct supportive policies.
Yeah, but you're talking about 4 times what's in the pipeline.
Well, New Zealand already has a per capita wind power capacity equal to the U.S., although it's much below Germany and Spain. So I think that New Zealand has been holding its own in terms of the wind industry and development here, and it's a matter of accelerating that. And policies like feed-in tariffs or portfolio standards could do that. Another example, solar hot water. You know, New Zealand now provides $1,000 credit for a subsidy for a solar hot water installation, which is only about 15% of the cost. And in most other countries, those subsidies are somewhere between 30 and 40%.
There are some parts of the country that have doubts about the sun shining enough to keep their water
hot. Yes.
on the business of tidal, is there a genuine prospect of using Cook Strait, or is that a massive project, a massive investment that's in the never-never?
I think it's probably going to come out to be too expensive. I mean, you talk about costs, you know, and nuclear is about the highest cost technology in the world right now, although some will dispute that. Wind is coming competitive with coal. Tidal and ocean forms of energy are still considered quite expensive, and I can't really say how that will change in the future. But I think that's probably a massive engineering undertaking that is actually not needed.
The business of clean technology that's going to save the world, the things like turning cars into electric cars and running grids so that you can, you know, as you say, wind power can end up fueling your car. Something like 85% of US venture capital, I think, is now going towards the so-called clean technology development. Is it a fad? Is that a level of investment realistic in terms of return? Or is it a real thing that is going to deliver and is delivering on the scale the world needs it?
Yeah. Well, up until last September, you had, you know, a booming clean tech sector, and that included renewable energy and energy efficiency technologies as well. And, you know, you saw 200 companies with market capitalization, you know, $40 million or more existing. You saw, as you say, huge investments in the venture capital, private equity sectors. So if all that had continued and all that was being done on the basis of profitability, I mean, these technologies were becoming very profitable and the prospects were very high. Of course, we've perhaps taken a break or a breather from that momentum given the current economic situation. But I think that the renewable energy sector could be one of the first to recover because people will see that that is a valuable investment, that, you know, that's, it's not, the risk is much lower than it, than it, than
except it
other
has a
potential
long
industries.
Term payoff, does it not? You're it not going to get this
payoff
next year or the year after.
You need large amounts of capital. You need to be able to borrow a lot of money
which
at
no
low
one has.
Interest rates. Well, interest rates are low, so that's very favorable towards renewables now. But now you have very little private capital, and so governments are starting to contribute a lot of financing for renewable energy. You've seen that in the US and in Europe.
Is New Zealand making the most then of this situation, apart from some private firms doing their own investment? Are we anything like geared up to be making the most of this?
No, I don't think so at all. I think that you were gearing up to that a year ago with the National Energy Strategy, and I would have even gone beyond what was proposed in that National Energy Strategy that came out. That was late 2007. I think that the situation now needs to change and go back more on that original track and even accelerate.
You've kind of gone out of your way, really, to become an expert on New Zealand and its potential because you've walked the length of it. You're one of those who've walked the Te Araroa track from Cape Reinga to Bluff.
Well, I first came here in 2003, and I fell in love with the country. I really did. I came here to take a six-month sabbatical from my...
Clear your mind.
Clear my mind. I had a high-pressure job at the World Bank for 6 or 7 years and had been working very hard and decided to walk the length of New Zealand. I had never been here before, but I started in Cape Reinga in October, and I ended up in the Bluff in April 2004, and I walked every step of the way, and that was about 100 days of tramping. That was 2,600 kilometers, and I got to see a lot of the country,
you know,
and
where the
meet
wind
a lot
is.
Of people.
Fair
and,
to say it's
felt the wind, yes.
Fair to say it's not a walk in the park, Eric?
Saw the biomass and felt the wind. It wasn't a walk in the park at all. People were extremely kind to me. I got tremendous help and assistance. I was just flabbergasted by how well I was treated, and so I vowed to come back and have now started to work here, and I do believe that New Zealand can achieve 100% renewables in the longer term, and that is my personal commitment, is to work towards that.
If you want to hear the ins and outs and the ups and downs in particular, and sometimes downs only, of Eric's walk, it's still on the website, I think, is it?
Yes, that's right. If you just Google my name, it'll come up about fourth.
Lovely talking to you. Dr. Eric Martineau, currently in New Zealand. Should we publicise your lecture tomorrow, or is there a risk that they won't be able to handle the turnout?
There will be a public lecture tomorrow in the Rutherford House at 5 o'clock, 5 to 6:30, on renewables and climate change, yes.
That's in Wellington.
Yes.
Thanks so much, Dr. Eric Martineau, currently based at Victoria University.